Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. We have a double feature this week. I've chosen a pair of episodes that were produced by Ken Lane that will put you in the mood for August. The first episode is Missing Tourists in Monsoon Season, from August 3, 2017. The second is The UFO Experience, Now Safe for Tourists, from August 11, 2017. Have fun with these.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Thunderstorms across the desert. Night has fallen on the Mojave, and you can stand outside at night and watch the whole desert light up. There's 29 Palms. There's Barstow. Oh, and look, that towering electrical insanity over the New York mountains in the preserve. Horizontal lightning on the horizon over the little San Bernardinos. And then, if you're lucky, the downpour. The temperature drops 30 degrees as cold rain batters the sand and the highway and your rooftop. I heard a weatherman calling such a thing a microburst, and I thought, what is wrong with everyone? Why do you people have to try to ruin everything? This is a cursed time of year for the desert visitor. Every August, right on time, people start disappearing. It happened again last week. It happens a lot in national parks and national forests. People just disappear. As for this current missing couple, of course it is hoped that they turn up. But 7 days in, you start to wonder. Maybe it was all planned. You can't blame anybody for wanting to drop all this banal madness, student loans and credit cards and car payments and health insurance premiums. Just fake your death in the desert and start fresh somewhere. Maybe Canada. Maybe the people got lost on an easy sundown walk down the road from their Airbnb. Maybe the interdimensional monsters got them. I recalled the dazzling white light hovering over the northern tip of the Joshua Tree Wilderness on that very night, last Thursday night. We watched it there for the longest time, and then it shot straight up. Way up where you see the jetliners on their way to Ontario and LAX. It lit up all green, and then green and red, and then it rotated and blinked out. What the hell was that? Who knows? Atmospheric abnormalities. Time-traveling devils. We can hope it's not the Marines testing some murder device over a protected national park. The Marines actually do a pretty good job at taking care of the desert around their base. They work with the Park Service and the Land Trust and all of that. Something they probably don't get enough credit for. You know those huge wildlife corridors connecting Joshua Tree National Park with the Mojave Preserve and Death Valley? The U.S. Marine Corps has bought and paid for much of that. The whole point of wildlife corridors, despite a name that's about as romantic as microburst, is to have plenty of space for the wide-ranging critters like bighorn and mountain lions, so that they've got room to breathe and places to rest and find food and mates. as the heat and the drought makes these refuges farther apart, fewer in number. You might be lucky enough to glimpse a shadowy mountain lion on your evening walk, but that same mountain lion might have a home range of 300 or 400 miles, especially in the desert where there's less of everything, less plants, less prey, more nights spent on the trail looking for food. There are all kinds of theories about what to do if you see a mountain lion, but you'll have to figure it out on your own should you be lucky enough to see a big cat in the wild. A popular camping spot at Joshua Tree National Park is the Black Rock Canyon Campground on the west end of the park, at the end of a dead-end road. But it wasn't always a national park campground. It was originally Jellystone Park, complete with statues of Yogi Bear. Now, it's a good campground. There are trails that go up to Eureka Peak and all the way over to Keys View. And there's a very interesting trail that winds through a low canyon to the spring, Black Rock Canyon Spring, where flocks of pinyon jays live in the pinyon trees there. Now, in September of 2010, a man named Edward Rosenthal drove up there from Los Angeles for a day hike. Because of the higher elevation, it's much more pleasant this time of year than much of Joshua Tree or 29 Palms or, God forbid, all the way down in Palm Springs, where the trails are simply closed for the summer season 8 or 9 months of the year. But Ed Rosenthal was in a very good mood. He had just made a big real estate deal as the broker for Clifton's Cafeteria in downtown Los Angeles. Clifton's is a landmark. It opened in 1931, just as the Great Depression was settling in. Now, Charles Bukowski used to eat there as a young man, and he writes in his book, Ham on Rye, that the owner of Clifton's allowed poor people to pay whatever they could so that nobody went hungry. It was owned by some nice old rich man, Bukowski wrote. A very unusual person. Science fiction writers loved the place too, as did members of various UFO and alien contact clubs in Los Angeles. Ray Bradbury was a regular, and so was Robert Heinlein and L. Ron Hubbard and Forrest Ackerman, all part of a gang of sci-fi writers who held weekly meetings there. The decrepit old Clifton's had been sold, and this guy, Ed Rosenthal, he made the deal. He was happy, and he went to his favorite place, Black Rock Canyon, just about 2 hours by car from downtown L.A., if the traffic's right. But it was a bad time of year for hiking, even at the higher altitudes. It was monsoon season, muggy and humid, the kind of weather that makes you want to give up and die. Weather like this, like we're having right now. Well, he walked and he walked and he got lost and he got confused, and then it was the midday sun, and before long it was the next day and the next day. For 6 days he was lost. He was smart, and he was smart enough to seek in the heat of the afternoon any kind of shade he could find, but he could not find his way back. He was turned around completely. He wound up all the way down by Desert Hot Springs, near the southern boundary of the national park. It was hot as hell down there, and he finally gave up. Writing on his hat with a ballpoint pen from his pocket, He made out a will and said goodbye to his wife and friends and family. But he didn't die. In fact, he was found alive just after he finished scribbling his last will and testament on the brim of his hat. They got him to the High Desert Medical Center, and he survived that, too. He was tired and dehydrated, but otherwise unhurt. Ed Rosenthal was a rare case. He vanished and was found alive in a desert wilderness. He lived to tell the tale. Every summer, tourists die in the desert national parks. Joshua Tree, Death Valley, Mojave National Preserve. They'll be walking around with their family and suddenly they have trouble breathing and they need to take a little rest. And then the pulse stops. Sometimes they're middle-aged hikers like Ed Rosenthal. In good shape and fairly familiar with the area. Sometimes they're young and healthy Germans on holiday. Sometimes they're regular Americans trying to see some nature. Regular Americans in regular lousy health, staggering around in the blinding sun, wondering why their cell phone won't work. Park rangers in the desert Southwest have a name for a particular kind of way that people die these days. Death by GPS. Tourists follow their car's navigation system, ignoring whatever common sense might otherwise prevent them from driving a rental car down a rough dirt road that leads them farther and farther away from water or help. And then they run out of gas or get stuck in the sand. And then they try to walk back in the 120-degree Death Valley summer heat, or the hot enough 100-plus in Joshua Tree. A couple of years ago, a young European couple disappeared up in the Joshua Tree wilderness. They had come for a summer vacation to see the Mojave because they loved that record by the Irish band U2, The Joshua Tree. Even though that record was made in Ireland, nowhere near the desert. And even though the Joshua Tree on the record's cover was up by Death Valley, a day's drive from Joshua Tree. Anyway, they got lost and they died. What can you do to survive in such situations? Well, don't take a rental car down a dirt road into the wilderness, for one thing. Don't rely on your cell phone because you won't have service outside of the towns and the visitor centers. Always have water in the car. A couple of those Crystal Geyser 2-gallon bottles will cost you about $3 and it might save your life. And if you don't need the water, you can use it to wash your arms or something. Tell people where you're going. Tell the ranger at the visitor center. Text somebody who might care if you go missing. And if you find yourself lost in the desert, don't get more lost. Stay with your car during the day. Move around so that you stay in the shady part. Don't sit inside. You're going to bake in there without air conditioning running. If you're on a road, you can walk back the way you came at night, after the sun goes down. Stay on the road. The only shortcuts lead to your funeral, which you probably can't afford anyway. And finally, if all else fails and your time is at hand, know that most people relax at the end. Find a place to sit down in the shade, if there's any shade. None of us live forever, and not enough of us get the time to sit alone in the quiet wilderness and contemplate our own existence, our place in the world. As surely as a single gopher snake or jackrabbit or centipede has a place in the world, we've got one too. You've got one too. Most of us never quite find it. The system, as it were, human civilization, doesn't much reward this kind of thing. It's a pretty good system overall. It's the best one we've had so far. But it has always depended on a fraction of its people to do the heavy spiritual lifting. You know, if everybody took a long walk in the desert every evening and sat on a boulder contemplating the world and refused to answer text messages in a timely manner and intentionally forgot their Facebook and LinkedIn logins, I guess we'd never get around to inventing some kind of worldwide taxi service that skims a few more dollars off a taxi driver's wages. We tell desert tales on this broadcast and within the pages of the Desert Oracle. But you can also experience such things in person during a limited engagement of Desert Oracle Campfire Stories at the Ace Hotel and Swim Club in Palm Springs, California on the first Thursday of the month. The next edition of our nighttime campfire stories at the Ace Hotel will be Thursday, September 7th. Outside, around a real campfire, free and open to all. But of course, we'll have a camp bar set up right there, along with blankets on the grass and log seats around the fire pit. You can also try the new Brush Fire cocktail, sales of which benefit the conservation efforts of the Mojave Desert Land Trust. September 7th, that's a Thursday night, the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs. We get started at about 7:30 p.m. It's really coming down out there. A contactee cult is a group of people united in belief of someone's experience with space monsters, aliens, star pilots from Venus or Mars. In the 1950s, following the first few nervous years of the UFO problem, thousands of regular people met in the desert, usually up at George Van Tassel's place north of Yucca Valley. Some of them had seen strange things in the sky, and some claimed that the strange things landed and took people aboard for whatever reasons. Probings, messages about nuclear war and the environmental devastation happening around them. Down in Desert Center, off the I-10, a contactee named George Adamski took some of the most famous UFO photographs. Skeptics said the pictures looked like somebody threw a hubcap across the sky. A true thing is that the desert produces consistently high levels of strangeness and occasional transcendence, as easily proven by talking to people who live within or near to the desert wilderness. Now, national opinion polls show that about 10% of Americans say they've seen a UFO. But that number climbs to about 95% if you talk to people around Joshua Tree or Sedona or Pahrump. Well, I'm sad to report that most people are still waterheads. One can certainly debate the progress of the species and whether or not there is a net increase in the basic intelligence and moral worthiness of our kind, but on a day-by-day basis, it can be difficult to see an uptick. For example, these trails here. Now, these trails, they seem to do a good job at letting you know where they are and where you should be, especially in a nature preserve, a conservation area, state or national park, etc. Yeah, and yet, these many mountain bicyclists here have decided it's a good idea to leave the trail whenever convenient and create new bicycle trails in the process, as you can see. The trail is here. And these bozos were not satisfied, I suppose, so now we have these new scars across the absurdly fragile desert crust, which is what supports the plants over here and holds it all together. It was holding it together. Now, look, they're probably good, upstanding citizens, you know. Educated millennials or whatever they're called, and they probably like to think that they give a hoot. And yet they're not quite right in the head. They apparently don't understand that if you walk or drive over everything, it will eventually look like the other places that are walked on and driven over. Roads and trailways with no plant life, no wildflowers in the spring, just sand and a lot of dead Joshua trees that have fallen over. Come on. Well, we probably shouldn't be out here when we're seeing lightning. Even if it appears to be in the distance. After all, there's not much out here that's taller than we are right here. Creosote plant now and then. A couple of these Joshua trees are getting up to 15 or 20 feet high, but they are few and far between. You know how most people are struck dead by lightning? Playing golf. And as Mark Twain said, nah, it doesn't matter. Previous broadcast, I mentioned a baffling experience with a pair of lights that chased me down Amboy Road the spring before last. I have since been made aware of the following. From the National UFO Reporting Center website. Reportedly having occurred the night of July 6th, 2017 at approximately 11:40 p.m. on Highway 79 outside the dot of a town called Warner Springs, just up the mountainside along Anza Borrego State Park. The summary said, tailgating vehicle disappears. Here's what this witness writes. Quote, while traveling east on Highway 79, another vehicle came up from behind and began tailgating me at 65 miles per hour. I slowed to 50 miles per hour to express my dissatisfaction with this miscreant. That didn't work, so I slowed again to about 40 miles per hour. Then the headlights from his vehicle just disappeared. I thought that he had foolishly shut them off, so I slowed to a near stop and carefully searched my rearview mirror. There was a moon, so I could see well. There was no vehicle, and I am certain that it did not leave the road, as this is cattle country with fencing coming all the way up to the shoulder of the road. There is only one dirt driveway on this stretch, but I was not upon that. There are no tall trees or tall brush along this road to hide a car. The vehicle did not pass nor turn around. It was just gone. End quote. Friends, the autumn issue of Desert Oracle is due in your P.O. box or other mail receptacle next month. But this will only occur if you are a current subscriber. Desert Oracle is the quarterly publication about the wonders and secrets of America's vast desert wilderness and the interesting little communities found around and within. Don't be on the wrong list in life. Become a subscriber today. Send $25 by check or money order to Desert Oracle, P.O. Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California. Or subscribe online at desertoracle.com. You'll receive four delightful pocket-sized issues of America's only quarterly magazine that's all about the desert Southwest. You know, we are happy to correspond with many interesting characters around and across these desert lands. One such individual has kindly purchased subscriptions to the Desert Oracle for many of his co-workers at a biological sciences concern here in the Western lands. And he gives them all crazy nicknames, like in a mafia movie. Now, he goes by Cyrano del Desierto, something like that. Anyway, he sent this god-awful noise you are about to hear, which is a wrecked upright piano this desert scientist found in a dry wash where so many treasures are found. Good Lord. Our broadcast also exists in the form of a podcast. It's called Desert Oracle Radio. You can subscribe for free on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and other such podcast delivery systems. Listen to episodes old and new. Tell your friends. Leave a review if you are so inclined. We do enjoy hearing from you in any form. For those of us blessed to live in the Mojave High Desert, you can hear us Fridays at 10 p.m. on KCDZ 107.7 FM from Amboy to Zizek's and across the Great Mojave. We close tonight with a few words from the pen of Sam Shepard, who passed away last week and left us with Western stories and poems and stage plays that always reward rereading. The following is from Motel Chronicles, our favorite slim volume of Sam Shepard's prose and poetry published by City Lights Books. Black cloud shadows on the Orocopia Mountains. Gigantic date palms, brown bags protecting their fruit. Alfalfa trucks, orange trucks filled with tires. Tangerine groves, ladders leaning on their trunks. Roofless stone foundations made from river rock. A single burned palm, nothing around it burned. Giant chunks of truck tires frying on the road. Trailered racing boat, solid chrome pipes. Dust blows all over Blythe, 101480, Coachella, California. That's our show for this evening. Good night. From the voice of the desert.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
And night has fallen on the desert. Once again, and it's the time of year when the night does not bring quite enough relief. It's the humidity, an unwelcome late summer visitor to our generally dry lands. It's the time of year when the doors won't shut all the way without a struggle, the wooden frames expanding with the moisture. Instead of the cool nights we thrive upon, everything's swampy and vile, like the Gulf Coast of Alabama or a theme park in Florida. There's something disheartening about checking the desert weather and seeing 80% humidity. But we survive it most of the time, and soon the air will be crisp and dry once again. Pretty soon. Meanwhile, there are yellow wildflowers blooming on the desert floor, tricked into life by thunderstorms. You might find you can smile or wrap your fingers around a pencil without the skin cracking and splitting as it tends to do in the wintertime. You may also notice how bad people smell as water in the air carries the odor of rock climbers and European tourists right to your nose, which is mostly unaccustomed to such things. It's used to inhaling dust storms and can be thrown into a mild state of shock when assaulted with so many smells. It's a time of year when everything feels a little bit more ridiculous, when a glance at the local news is enough to suggest the heat has gotten the best of people, when weird schemes come to life and you can't help but wonder how tragically they'll fall apart. A marijuana company in California paid a $200,000 deposit to purchase the very little town of Nipton, alongside Mojave National Preserve, just a few miles from the Nevada state line. The company, called American Green, intends to do God knows what. The reports mention vague things such as marijuana tourism, because why not? Although intensive agriculture and groundwater usage is hardly what you'd hope to see along the boundary of a national park. After all, it was the hideous construction of the enormous Ivanpah Solar Factory that killed Nipton's hopes of being a much-needed park village of sorts for the Mojave Preserve. A man named Jerry Freeman worked on that little town for decades. He worked toward making Nipton an eco-resort, as it was next to a beautiful national park with no lodging and no food and, most importantly, no saloon. But he died last year, and the town has been up for sale ever since. The asking price? $5 million. Now, Nipton is not a bad place. It's got a railroad track that goes right through it. You can listen to the freight trains at night. And I'd gladly live in Nipton for free, but $5 million is a bit steep for a place in the middle of the desert called the Lonesome Triangle. Now, if I had a marijuana company in the Mojave, I'd call it Mojave Green, after our notorious rattlesnake. Now, I know a lot of desert biologists and conservationists, and they are without doubt good people of high moral character, but one thing they like to do is lecture people about calling the Mojave Green a Mojave Green, despite the fact that everybody calls the Mojave Green a Mojave Green, and that's what they've been called for as long as the English language has been spoken upon these arid lands. You know, the first thing any science page or Wikipedia entry always says when you're looking up the Mojave Green is something like, incorrectly called the Mojave Green. Some people say you're supposed to call it a Mojave rattlesnake, because not all Mojave greens have green coloring. Humans may complain a bit about the weather this time of year, but these snakes seem to like it just fine. You see more of them, and you see more of them in the evening. Last week I saw something I'd never seen before, a baby king snake. A fast-moving shape across the sandy trail, black and white, 5, maybe 6 inches long. Think of all the times you've been out on the trail, walking a sandy wash. and all the animals you've only seen once. There are so many strange and interesting things we can see in the desert, and some people come all the way out to the desert from wherever they live to watch the skies for meteor showers, military aircraft. And many people come out specifically to try to see a UFO. We recently spoke to Brendan Mays about his plans to bring a UFO experience to the high desert.
It's not so much a platform as it is an underground bunker, kind of like a camera obscura setup, where in the safety of an underground chamber, you can view the flying saucers, the UFOs, you know, from a safe, secure location. You will be safe, and everybody, the plan is everybody is to wear a monitoring bracelet that keeps track of them at all times. We want to make it as safe as possible for tourists to view UFOs, flying saucers. It's going to be safe. We're going to be there to monitor everything, so nothing gets too out of hand. I was trained as a chemist, a scientist, so, you know, I'm always looking for empirical evidence, and I'm always looking for the hard facts to back up any sort of theory or ideas people have. And I haven't come across too much good empirical evidence, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. People believe in something strongly enough, you know, who am I to say that they're wrong? They might know something. They may be able to tap into some metaphysical thing that I'm not too aware of. They might be seeing stuff that's actually there. Maybe I can't see it. I mean, who am I to judge? Who am I to say that these people are wrong? I do have quite a few vacation rentals scattered all throughout the valley, which is where I actually plan on putting the bunker. A girl from Romania, her name is Vladova, she was the one who actually turned us on to the idea that UFOs are real and that there's a great interest around the world in reaching out to civilizations, you know, beyond our solar system. She believed that she had been visited by aliens. She used a term for them. She called them the tall grays, and they clued her in that they're going to be making, they like visiting certain places, and one of them is through the deserts of California, the Mojave, and all the way out to Nevada. They like going to places, but there's not necessarily tons of people. She really opened my eyes to a lot of things. One of them was obviously the possibility of space travel, and time travel too is a big component of it. All those people, I guess, from what she told me, that have photoreceptors in their eyes that can see just past the infrared spectrum, and there's a lot of information being exchanged in that particular electromagnetic wavelength. Supposedly that's the way they're communicating with, I guess we can't see it, but it would be akin to flashes of lightning or pulses of light. It's like a rapid transmission of information. Basically thought transmissions or thought patterns or thought prints that are transmitted in this very narrow range. And I guess the people that have these particular receptors in their eyes, I think they're in their eyes, but they can pick up these frequencies. And if you're listening close enough, there is information in there being transmitted in the form of thought patterns. Also referred to as a stroke of genius, because it's like having a little mini stroke. You might speak in tongues a little bit, left side of your face might go numb. All these things kind of occur in the same time. None of this stuff, you know, this is all stuff that people tell me. And these people tell me this stuff and they believe it. And they believe you look them right in the eye and they're telling you the truth. So it's kind of really not for me to judge whether or not it's real. And if they say it's real. And I haven't experienced it myself. So, you know, who am I to say that this isn't real or not real? They're saying it's real. I believe them. It seemed like for a while there in the 90s and early 2000s that the interest in UFOs and alien visitors was kind of on the wane, seemed to be on the decline, but now it seems to be coming back pretty strong. I gotta say, it's kind of heartening. It's almost inspirational to see these people searching for a truth or a higher meaning or power out there, and I'm just glad to be a part of it. The UFO viewing area, we haven't decided exactly where to put it yet, but the basic idea is that it's going to be an underground bunker with a periscope, basically. And it's not a real periscope. I mean, it's all cameras and stuff, all set up around the outside. It's like a remote viewing center. And so you're down in the earth about 50 feet in an underground chamber. And there are cameras up top that, and a bunch of other sensors. There's electromagnetic wave detectors. There's a spectral anagraph. We've got gas chromatographs running up there, constantly sampling the air to see what sort of disturbances. We have pressure gradient detectors to see if there's anything flying around, if anything lands on the ground. All this information.
The people, instead of being outside where they could perhaps see some sort of anomalous aerial phenomena.
Well, they'll be able to see it. There's that down inside the bunker, we plan on putting 4K monitors all around the walls for like an immersive experience. We also have microphones actively recording everything on the surface and transmitting it down into the chamber. So it's basically like you're there. It's like you're outside, pretty close. They're going to be safe, is the point. And I know a lot of the millennials are afraid of a lot of things, I've noticed. We run into a little bit of trouble with the county on this. They have a lot of questions. We're kind of thinking that maybe it's better to ask for forgiveness than for permission. You know what I'm saying? We're going to build it. We're going to see what kind of response we get. And if the response is strong, they're going to let us do whatever we want. Basically, it's going to be like kind of like that Airbnb situation that I had a few years ago. You know, people are against it, people are angry, but you know what? It makes a lot of money. And money, it turns out, is pretty important. And people respond to money. I think we can get retroactive on a lot of our stuff with the permitting and all that. I'm not too concerned about that because we are self-funded. Like I said, I've made quite a bit of money buying up ramshackle cabins all around the high desert, putting on a solar panel and a swamp cooler and charging people experience the desert and the magic that it is. So I haven't really come up with any sort of marketing slogan or elevator pitch to investors because that's not really it's not really necessary. What we've done is we've hired a team of what are called social influencers. You know, young people who have a certain amount of style or flair, or they're good with makeup, or maybe they're great at fixing up old camper vans or whatever they do. But these kids have a lot of pull and a lot of influence. They got YouTube channels. They're doing things on Snapchat. People follow them and they listen to what these kids have to say. So we hired a firm out in Los Angeles, one of these social influencing agencies. They've promised us that they're gonna get people excited, and they're gonna get people involved, and they have a proven track record with getting people into all sorts of things. It's an immersive experience. It's like an immersive virtual reality experience. So it's a lot more than just sitting out in the desert. And you know, sitting out in the desert has a lot of risks. There's the risks of being bitten by a Gila monster. There's the risks of maybe a rattlesnake is gonna bite you in the middle of the night. There's all these disconcerting, I'd say, to a lot of these young people. I mean, they're interested in it, but they don't want to get too close because they're not sure how they're going to react to it. They're going to get bitten. Are they going to get scared? They're not sure. So what we're trying to give to them is saying, we're going to shield you from all of the crazy critters out there, so you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. No night owl is going to come down and get you by the back of the neck. And that's not what this is about. This is about safety and security. Well, when we originally tried to do this, we were trying to find some of the unused missile silos they had out in the northern Mojave and in an area, what is commonly referred to as Area 51. So we're looking for abandoned silos, we're looking for abandoned hardened military bases, but the military didn't want to play ball with us, so we're going to try to recreate the experience. I've been to a couple of the old airplane and aerospace wrecking yards out in Mojave, picking up little pieces here and there, control panels, wiring looms, you know, to give them an immersive experience and make it feel as if they were in some sort of a Cold War installation. So we're going for the experience since we can't get the exact real thing.
I want to tell you something about Elvis Presley, and it's very important, so I want to make sure I get it right. Elvis Presley was a person who was very, very concerned about his hair. At every phase of his career, the height and heft of his hair was remarkable. His hair started going white when he was in his late 20s. As a result, he had to dye it black. And this is why rockabilly people insist on dyeing their hair black to this day. Elvis Presley's hairdresser was a guy named Larry, and he was also a New Age mystic, as your hairdresser often is. He knew about everything. He knew about tarot cards and astrology. He knew about past lives, transcendental meditation, ghosts. Well, he and Elvis got in the car and went up to Joshua Tree during a break from Elvis's big comeback engagement in Las Vegas. And sure enough, they saw a classic triangle, a big black triangle, hovering over them on the road with the white beam of light. They were impressed. They were probably on more pills than a pharmacy has. But they believed it and they were moved by it. A week later, they were both back at Graceland, outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And in broad daylight, they saw that same ship over Graceland. It all started to add up for Elvis Presley. When he was 8 years old, he started having visions of being in some sort of shared communication with entities of some kind. It was only after his mother died that his father, Vernon, told him that on the night Elvis Presley was born in Tupelo, in a sharecropper's shack, an oval-shaped thing flew out of the clouds, hovered over the house, and shined a beam on the house. They knew about Elvis from the start. A Marine tells the story of taking the back way to Las Vegas. This is from 29 Palms to Las Vegas. You can get there barely touching an interstate, which means it's also a very beautiful drive. And this one goes through Mojave National Preserve, a little visited part of the national park system. But Marines generally know it as a shortcut. And a lot of people in Palm Springs call it the back way to Vegas as well. You come out of the base, you go through Wonder Valley, you get on Amboy Road. Then you come across the railroad tracks, and there's Roy's, the old one-time 24-hour motel, cafe, diner, gas station on Route 66. The place had so many customers when that was the road that they had an entire town just for the staff behind it. 24 hours a day, you could get a chicken fried steak, you could get your oil changed, you could get your tires switched. But then the interstate opened just 18 miles to the north. And the day the interstate opened, Roy's business was killed. The owner was so furious, he went around in a bulldozer knocking down half the town. What's there today is what he forgot to knock down. Well, the Marine goes by Roy's. And then he turned left on Kelbaker Road. And it was here that he came across a scene that didn't seem right at all. It was a red Miata, one of those little convertible sports cars, spun out in the middle of the road. There were suitcases knocked all around, a purse, clothes knocked around. And then on the blacktop, right on the yellow line, were two people, face down, spread out, hurt or maybe dead. He came to a stop, He got his sidearm. And he walked over to be a good Samaritan. As dark as it was, from his headlights, he caught the reflection of eyes watching from the side of the highway. And as he turned around and started running back to his car, he saw these people rise up from the brush and run towards him. He got in the car and nearly chopped off his own foot in the process, slammed the door, weaved around the suitcases and the junk, around the Miata, around the people who were now getting up on their knees, apparently dead no longer. He says he drove about 110 miles an hour the rest of the way, which is kind of a feat on a twisting two-lane.
Alice Salter from Page, Arizona writes, I was surprised to find Desert Oracle now has a radio show. Can you explain why? Well, Alice, in the summer of 1983, 34 years ago, I had saved up enough money to drive around America for a month or two. Just 6 months prior, I discovered the writer Edward Abbey and was now like a religious pilgrim driven to frenzy and irrational behavior, except my destination wasn't Mecca or Bethlehem, it was Arches National Park, the former Arches National Monument, where Ed Abbey had been a seasonal park ranger and where his book Desert Solitaire takes place. Well, I wandered around that part of Utah for as long as I could, and one morning I realized there were 750 miles between me and a promised arrival at the home of some family friends, oil field workers, who were expecting me in a tiny West Texas town called Kermit, a place of about 5,000 souls on the western edge of the Odessa Midland metropolitan area, such as it is. A lot of driving would be necessary to get there in 2 days, and it's one of the most dramatic drives in the world. Through country that seems too ridiculous to be real, slick rock and arches, juniper scattered on red mountains. The Four Corners is a land of magic and terror. Between Dove Creek and Cortez in the southwestern corner of Colorado, I watched a monstrous thunderstorm that stretched 100 miles across the plateau, the San Juan Mountains blurring into the purple storm. I was searching the radio dial, searching for something. Something with a message. I'd go through static and farm reports, and then this manic hillbilly guitar jumping out of the dashboard speaker with impossible levels of reverb, someone howling with weird abandon. There were several numbers like this, primal rockabilly about flying saucers and knife fights, and then the music crashed to an end and the howls continued, but from the DJ. His voice layered over itself from the modulation and the lightning strikes crashing through the AM signal. Lightning strikes from the thunderstorm, now right on top of me. For 2 or 3 harrowing hours, I crept southward on U.S. Highway 666, long since renamed by politicians who knew to be scared of the devil. Gallup, New Mexico was somewhere on the other side of these giant white bolts exploding around me, a heavy mix of hail and rain making it impossible to steer with any confidence. A monstrous wedge appeared in the sky, backlit by the bluish-white electric glow of another crashing bolt. This was the Shiprock, the remains of an ancient volcano within the Navajo Nation. Well, the storm had settled into a steady rain just as I rolled into town. At the crossroad with Route 66, I found a motel called the Thunderbird, and outside on the shoulder of the road was a phone booth with the glass shot out, and when I walked out there to make a call, I saw a knocked-over highway sign. Two signs, actually, one of them a coveted U.S. Route 66 marker. Well, I got the toolbox and the socket wrench set from my dear old international scout, and I crouched in the highway weeds as the rain poured down, and I brought those signs home. Route 66 officially vanished a year later and became the subject of many nostalgic television features and newspaper articles. But the thing I remember so well, so many years later, is that summer night madman disc jockey on that station out of Durango. And I figured someday, one way or another, I'd like to do that kind of radio show that I'd like to come across on some lonesome desert drive. Well, Route 66 didn't disappear for good. It had too big a place in the story of America. Now you can drive many desert sections of the old US 66, complete with old-fashioned highway signs and including a nice two-lane stretch of the Mother Road that runs right through Mojave Trail's National Monument. Stop at Roy's and tell him the Desert Oracle sent you. That is about it for us tonight on Desert Oracle Radio. You can subscribe to the podcast version of the broadcast on iTunes. You can listen on TuneIn, the radio app. If you live in the high desert, you can listen on 107.7 FM. That's KCDZ FM in Joshua Tree, California. We're brought to you by Desert Oracle Magazine. It's a pocket-sized field guide to the mysterious and grand American desert. You can find the latest issue around the Southwest. Try Sedona Outdoors on Main Street in Sedona, or the California Visitor Center in Yucca Valley, or in Joshua Tree, the Coyote Corner. Thursday, September 7th, we do live campfire stories at the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs. Write to us, radio@desertoracle.com, and good night from the voice of the desert.
Well, as I told you last week, I've been traveling, collecting people's stories. Here's one from a couple I encountered on the Swift Current Lake Trail in Glacier National Park. Okay, I'm on the Swift Current Lake Trail and have met a couple of very nice people that took my picture. And I'm going to ask them a question that I always am curious about. So, why do you like this area?
The beauty.
Well, the beauty. Our son's up here.
Our son's at the border.
But no, there's nothing like Glacier. We were at Waterton earlier, but Glacier is just, it's absolutely gorgeous. And the whole Manny Glacier experience is
gorgeous.
Our favorite place. So.
And hiking people are the friendliest.
Yeah.
They are like one with nature, and they're amazing. They're quite awesome.
Has there been one experience that really stands out in your mind that you could tell a little story about?
Our son has an Arctic Fox camper on top of his big Ford truck, and we camped there up in Banff, and a mama grizzly and her cub came to our campsite. To me, that was the highlight. It was kind of scary, but awesome. Awesome.
The other one was going by Logan's Pass, that we took the Highline Trail, and the idea of the hose and the sheer nature, it was pretty scary. And he didn't tell his mom that, you know, there was a very narrow cliff overhang that she had to kind of walk through.
And hold on to the hose.
Or she never would have made the trip.
It's a hose line bolted into the rock.
By the time we got into it.
So you have to hold on to it because you're looking straight down.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty challenging. And we got up early in the morning, drove up, got a parking spot at the stop up on Sun, going to the Sun Road. And so we got there very early, probably 6:30.
Thank goodness.
Maybe it was 6, and got out on the trail, but it was absolutely
just
breathtaking.
Just beautiful.
Yeah.
It was gratifying to know we got there and got back in one piece.
No incident. It was a challenge.
It was a challenge.
Thank you, Gallatin Valley, for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. Well, that's it for today, so till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. I'll be back next week with the most recent episode of Desert Oracle Radio, and Beloved Mountain is taking us out again this time with some doodling on his guitar strings here at the cabin.